Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks is off today, and maybe you are too, because today is Labor Day, the federal holiday in honor of working men and women. Labor Day was created in 1894 in the wake of a nationwide railroad strike that was a major tipping point in the American labor movement. The strike paralyzed the country. At the time, railroads were the country's most important economic and communications arteries. Riots broke out, 30 people were killed, and the federal government went to court to get the trains moving again. In an effort to placate unions, President Grover Cleveland championed a bill to create Labor Day. The bill made its way through Congress and to the president's desk in a mere 6 days. Such was the power of unions in the 1890s. By the mid-1950s, 35% of the American workforce was unionized. But today, that number has dropped to 10%, the lowest rate of union membership since 1916, a fact which leads many to believe that American unions are dying. Earlier this year, we spoke with Thomas Cochin, professor of management and co-director of the Institute for Work and Employment Research at MIT. He'd written a piece on Cognoscenti, WBUR's opinion page, headlined, Four Ideas Labor Unions Should Consider If They Want to Survive. We were joined also by Brian Lang, president of the Boston Union, Unite Here, Local 26. Professor Cochin, let me start with you. First of all, why don't you just run through what you think the first couple of your ideas to help unions survive? I mean, it's pretty much baked in the cake that the numbers are as low as they've ever been. You're working on how to maybe raise those numbers. So what are your top two ideas?
Well, the top idea is to first throw off the chains of the current labor law that is so badly broken that it doesn't protect workers' rights to organize, and to think of new ways of reaching workers based on what they really care about. They want a voice on the job, they want respect on the job, and they certainly want improved wages and benefits. But just go out and talk to workers, learn what they want, and start to represent them in new ways.
Isn't that what they're already doing, though? I mean, that's
no.
What...
Well, one of the things that they could do, for example, is use more of the social media strategies. Use the ways in which workers network. Create applications, apps, I suppose, is the modern word, that allow workers to know where the good jobs are, where the bad jobs are. Tell workers to start reporting what they find about good opportunities and bad opportunities. That's one thing that could be done. The second thing is to recognize that right now the strategy for organizing focuses on bad employers, the employers where workers are really upset. We have to have a strategy that says workers should have a voice on all employment relationships. Go after workers for good employers and bad employers and say, we will be with you for the rest of your career. We'll provide training, we'll provide workforce development, we'll provide opportunities for referrals to new jobs where they come along. We'll help you to get retrained as technologies change, and say, we are with you for your full career. Those two things, I think, would be steps in the right direction.
Okay, well, we have Brian Lang here, who, you know, is president of Unite Here, a hospitality workers union in Boston. I mean, what do you make of sort of pulling in social media into more of what unions are about and supporting workers, as Professor Cochin is saying, you know, through their entire careers? Does that sound like something you could do or are already doing?
We are doing it. I would add this, that for us to become relevant, because there's no question about it, the relevancy of unions today is in jeopardy. There's no question. But for us to become relevant, we have to start talking about ourselves in the present, not like it's 50 years ago. And
what does that mean? What's the difference between the two in your mind?
Well, 50 years ago, 34% of all workers in the private sector were involved in unions. So they understood what a union is. Today, around 6% are. So very few people, when you think about it, in the workforce, understand what a union is. And so the way we try to define our union, Boston's Local 26, is We're members of our community in our neighborhood, and we work to bring value to our neighborhoods by representing workers in one of the expanding industries, an industry that has expanded, I think, 11 of the last 12 years, that is drawing in outside companies to build hotels and run hotels, that we're saying that we have values here in Boston, that if you want to come to Boston to work, our communities need to benefit from that.
Okay, so let me ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Professor Cohen. I mean, your other two ideas have to do with developing a national online workplace survey that workers can use to, as you say, rate employers and how they are in as places to work. And then you also say building closer partnerships and nurturing employee engagement with employers. And we'll talk about more of that in a minute. But there was quite a bit of response to your Cognoscenti post online, and I think a lot of people really make a good point, and that first and foremost is every single one of your 4 points places the onus on unions themselves and nothing really on employers in terms of their relationship with unions. And I point that out because, you know, we are living in a world where, as we said in the lead, what, 24 states are right-to-work states now, and membership is at an all-time low, and, you know, union members feel incredible pressure from all sides, you know, just to stay alive. So why is it all on them to better the relationship with employers when, you know, there's people on both sides of the table here?
Well, I think unions have to do both things. They have to really work hard to represent workers when employers are unfair, and there's plenty of that out there in the economy, and unions know how to do that. But they also have to stop just being victims and being backed into a corner to say everybody is against us, and they have to take a more proactive approach. And that's why working in partnership with those employers that do respect worker rights. We do a lot of work right now with Kaiser Permanente, where there's a coalition of 26 different local unions, 9 different national unions, working in partnership to improve health care. That's a positive example where the unions were the driving force in creating that partnership. That's the kind of example where I think we can see much more progress being made.
But on the other hand, if I may, on the other hand, we have a listener, Jose Michael Rodriguez, who posted on our Facebook page. He said, unions must take an adversarial position with management because of competing interests, pay versus profit. It's now and will always have a place in this and all societies that want safeguards against the excesses of capitalism and some corporations. So he sees unions as that safeguard, and the tension will always be there because there's strength in numbers.
Sure, that's true, but that's not enough anymore. It's not enough just to be defending against capitalism. We have to use the tools that we know how workers can add value to the workplace. Just what Brian said, add value to the workplace, add value to the community, and be a positive force for change. That's, I think, the future of the labor movement. But that does not at all take away the need for workers to stand up for worker rights when there's injustice. There's plenty of employers out there that don't respect worker rights. We should fix that. We should fix our labor laws so that workers are protected. But we can't just wait for that day to happen. The labor movement has to get proactive, working with the community, getting out there and demonstrating that they can add value at the workplace, and they can be a positive force in workers' lives.
Just a second, if I may, because I want to remind listeners that we're talking about 4 new ideas to revitalize unions for America in the 21st century. My guests are Professor Thomas Cohen. He's co-director of the Institute of Work and Employment Research at the MIT Sloan School of Management. He's also a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page, where he's posted these 4 ideas. There's a link to that at radioboston.org. I'm also joined by Brian Lang. He's president of Unite Here, a Boston-based hospitality worker union. And listeners, I know you've been listening so far, so what do you make of these ideas that you're hearing about keeping unions strong and viable in the 21st century? Does it sound like maybe, you know, an aspect of this might be creating a social network for labor? I mean, is that one of the ways forward for unions? Or are you hearing essentially a diminishment of their power as the voice in collective bargaining? How would you modernize unions? Or are you one of those listeners who's just happy to see them go? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Brian Lang, I interrupted you
there.
Tom's
point, to Tom's point, I think we have to go down parallel tracks as unions. On the one hand, we have to be organized and ready to fight. And we do have to fight. In Local 26, we've had strikes. We've run boycotts. We've had picket lines and rallies and all of the things that people commonly associate with a fighting union. And we organize our membership, and we have a strong rank-and-file leadership core. We do that on the one hand. On the other hand, we have relationships with the best hospitality employers in New England. And those relationships are mature relationships where we work jointly on workforce development. We have an education and training program that has 6 levels of English, that has citizenship classes, that has culinary arts, that has server training. It benefits the industry, so the industry in the Boston area can be that much better and attract more people to Boston.
Do they see it as benefiting them?
Absolutely. A matter of fact, it wouldn't work unless there was a genuine partnership there.
So then why aren't we seeing more such relationships between labor and large employers?
Because there aren't a lot of enlightened employers out there. And quite frankly, most enlightened employers that we've had contact with become educated through that fight that I described.
Mm.
And the only way to have an equal relationship is to do that as a union.
Well, this brings me to a point that someone on the Cognoscenti page, a point that they made. Tom Divney said, "Unions are missing the boat. Workers want better conditions, but many don't like unions' hardline, often dogmatic approach to relations with management."
That's right. That's exactly right. That's why in order for unions to be effective, they have to be democratically controlled by the membership. There has to be transparency. The voice of the union can no longer be older, graying white guys who think they're speaking for the immigrant workforce that they may be leading. The face of our union is our members, and our union works because our members control the direction of our union.
And Thomas Culkin, did you have something to say about that?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And in fact, if to go back to the Kaiser Permanente, the way in which that partnership got formed was there was a crisis in the late 1990s where the union said either we are going to go to war or we are going to have an alternative partnership approach. They didn't have a clue as to what that meant yet, but it evolved over time. And now you see in that relationship, you see when you go out there, workers, black workers, white workers, Latinos, people from Asia, people of all ages, men and women, it's a mosaic of our society working together on the front lines to improve health care and being proud of what they do and proud of being union members. That's the power that we have in these partnerships. But it only happened because you had a strong labor union set of labor unions in the first place that could force the employer to make a choice.
Mm. Now, what about in the case where, you know, there's this wonderful, happy partnership, everyone's getting along, it seems like a win-win for all, but there is continuously this concern that when things go wrong, there's no enforcement mechanism, and then suddenly you go back to, you know, where the adversarial positions that people started from.
Let's be clear. There's no utopia out there. It's a dynamic relationship. It's not without tension. It's not without struggle. It's not without disagreements. That exists. But when I said that we have a mature relationship with the best hospitality, and I underline, best hospitality employers in New England are the unionized Boston hotel employers. We can sit down and find the path to discover where our mutual interest is.
Is one of the things that still remains at the heart of the purpose of the union, of your union, is collective bargaining?
The heart of the purpose of our union is to transfer wealth into our communities. And what that means is we have members that own homes in Dorchester and East Boston and Mattapan and Roxbury, are part of revitalizing those neighborhoods because they can be home with their children. They can go to their parent-teacher conferences. They have health care, so they have healthy families. They can become citizens and participate in civic engagement. They have a free prepaid legal plan if they have legal problems. All of these things are paid for by the enlightened employers that I'm talking about.
I know some people out there, when they hear you say the words transfer wealth into the communities, they say, well, that may not be in the best interests of business who are, you know, providing the employment in the first place.
And that's why sometimes we have to fight. And the way that we fight is we organize our allies in the communities, we organize our members, and we make it clear that if you're going to do business in Boston, you have to have Boston values.
Hmm. Let's take a quick call here. Michael's calling from Somerville. You're on the air, Michael.
Hi there. This is Mike Grunko, former president of 509 SEIU.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Brian. Brian's local is a fighting local, and we've always enjoyed helping them whenever they had the opportunity. My own local is organizing actively in the human services area, nonprofits, and has a good base of public employees. And we use many of the tactics with social media and very involving. One of the things that we find is that in these community residences and agency, nonprofit agencies, people are working two and three jobs. And if we can organize one place and begin to provide services to those workers, they'll go to their second job or their third job, and they'll start to spread the news.
Mm-hmm.
And we can actually then go ahead and catapult that. But these are people who aren't making very much money. It's a very, very hard thing, and what Brian and what his predecessors have accomplished there in the hospitality industry is just terrific.
Michael, I'm sorry to interrupt you because I'm running down on time, but I really thank you for your call because it sparked a question in my mind. Thomas Kochan, I mean, as we were hearing Brian Lang talking about, like, we have this whole suite. He's got this whole mm-hmm. suite of I don't want to say tactics, but programs that he's working on with both union members and employers. But how many unions out there are doing exactly this thing? I mean, Michael was just talking about it's hard to get union leadership in other unions to think this way.
Yeah, well, if we could just clone these examples, we would get ourselves out of this mess in a hurry. But unfortunately, it's still a minority of the labor movement. But it's a growing minority, and it's a growing minority particularly among young labor leaders and among women who are taking a more active role in labor leadership around the country. It's more active in low-wage occupations than you see in some others. So I think it's growing, but it's a very small number. And it's fighting such an uphill battle because you have such hurdles under our labor law. You have so many employers who resist even these kinds of progressive efforts. And so we just have to keep growing them. And programs like this are really important mm-hmm. because so many young people that I encounter in colleges don't have a clue as to what the labor movement has done, could do, and why we need a vibrant, innovative labor movement in society. And so we need to educate people.
We've just got about 60 seconds to go, and I want to close with a question that was asked on our Cognoscenti page at WBUR.org, and it comes from Mickey Long. He says, you know, while he appreciates your work, he disagrees with you because he thinks unions need to focus solely on two things. One is getting and keeping the right to organize, and he says in parentheses, no, they do not have it. And two, meeting their own members' needs, not all workers' needs. So with this idea of even just the basic right to organize, still
we cannot wait. We cannot wait for the law to change. We have to organize now, and we can. 12 years ago, there were 12 hotels in Local 26. Today, there's 27, and we're continuing to organize. It can be done. Workers are hungry for organization. You just have to get out there and talk to them.
Thomas Kochan, quick.
Oh, I agree. The law is broken. You have to get around the law. You have to organize in whatever way works in your community by building these kinds of alliances. And then maybe someday, way down the road, we'll wake up in society and say, let's fix this law and let's update it to meet the needs of today's workforce.
Thomas Kochan is professor of management and co-director of the Institute for Work and Employment Research at MIT. Brian Lang is president of Unite Here, Local 26. There's a link to the piece, Four Ideas Labor Unions Should Consider If They Want to Survive, at our website, radioboston.org. Up next, why Massachusetts is amongst the worst when it comes to pay inequity between men and women. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.